This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars, episode 93, was recorded on February 10th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. Forest for the Trees founder Luke Grohman is back, and we've got a terrific interview coming up. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast when it comes to quant and rules-based investing. I'll tell you how to claim a free copy of their new guide to the best investing books ever written at the end of this episode. Luke, it's great to have you back on the show. It's been a little while. What's got your attention recently?
Yeah, hi, Eric. Thanks for having me back on. It's always great to be back. You know, what's caught my attention recently is a case of what I would call conspiracy theory becoming conspiracy fact. And by that, I mean, last week, Bloomberg reported that JP Morgan is under criminal investigation for its role in its precious metals desk's manipulation of precious metals markets. And so it was a Bloomberg article, JP Morgan's role in precious metal spoofing is under U.S. criminal probe. And it said U.S. authorities that accused six JP Morgan employees of rigging precious metals futures are building a criminal case against the bank itself, two people familiar with the situation said. Previously unreported investigation of the global bank's parent company, part of a wide-ranging federal clampdown on market manipulation, raises the prospect of criminal charges and significant fines against America's largest bank. And so the investigation detailed in the article is an expansion of racketeering charges that were leveled by the U.S. government against J.P. Morgan's precious metals desk back in September, as the U.S. invoked RICO statutes that are more typically used in mafia cases, and they used it against J.P. Morgan's price manipulation of precious metals markets, which lasted, according to the indictment, quote, nearly a decade. And so I'm going to read another quick article headline and excerpt here. From Bloomberg, September 16th, 2019, J.P. Morgan's metals desk was a criminal enterprise, U.S. says, invoking rarely used RICO statutes. So there's just the excerpt says, U.S. prosecutors took an unusually aggressive turn in their investigation of price fixing at J.P. Morgan, describing its precious metals trading desk as a criminal enterprise operating inside the bank for nearly a decade. The prosecutors charged the head of J.P. Morgan's global precious metals trading operation and two others on Monday, accusing them of, quote, conspiracy to conduct the affairs of an enterprise involved in interstate or foreign commerce through a pattern of racketeering activity, end quote. And now, that article about racketeering charges against the J.P. Morgan's precious metals desk was published on September 16th, 2019, like I said. Do you remember what else was happening on September 16th?
Oh, I absolutely do. And I have to say, Luke, I'm a little surprised that you see so much difference between an investment bank's trading desk and the mafia. To me, I've always thought of them as kind of in the same category. But there's no doubt in my mind. I remember exactly that day because it was the Monday after we had the Saudi attacks in Abqaiq, Saudi Arabia, where the missile attacks had caused a lot of people to think that half of the world's oil supply was going offline for an indeterminate period, which, of course, was an exaggerated fear. But I think also, if I remember correctly, that was also either the day or maybe one day before the day when the repo spike went critical. So I'm not sure which of those events you're remembering, but the one I remember was the oil event.
Oh, for sure. No, you got them both right. So kudos. I tip my cap. No, that's exactly right. So that Saturday the 14th was the Saudi oil attack. And so we opened, you know, oil gapped up on Sunday night / Monday morning, you know, Monday morning, September 16th. And then, you know, repo rates up on the 16th and up big on the 17th the day after. So exactly. I mean, and so fascinatingly, you have J.P. Morgan's precious metals desk get indicted on racketeering charges for manipulating the precious metals markets. And almost nobody noticed because of the Saudi oil field attacks and then the repo rate spike. And pretty much the repo in particular, all that anybody's been talking about ever since, myself included. And so even with last week's article that the U.S. government's now looking at criminal charges against J.P. Morgan itself for what was happening on the precious metals desk, it still seems like very few people have noticed it. But, you know, to me, it seems like the markets began noticing back in September.
Okay, when you say nobody's really noticing it, but the market noticed in September, what do you mean by that? Based on movements in precious metals prices or what?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, you know, if you look, you know, basically the exact moment that JP Morgan's precious metals desk got indicted for racketeering back in September, gold diverged from the global stock of negative yielding debt that it had been tracking with very closely for almost 2 years at that point. And ever since then, it's remained diverged from the stock of global negative yielding debt. And there's a chart from Bloomberg that John Reed at the World Gold Council put up that I'll put on Twitter for your listeners that shows this chart now, that shows this divergence that took place and has remained ever since JP Morgan's precious metals desk got indicted on September 16th for racketeering. So, you know, to be clear, I don't think JP Morgan's going to be convicted of precious metals manipulation or that it'll even go to trial or that it'll even hurt their stock. I mean, it's just not how things work in the U.S. And that's not a political statement. That's just a statement of fact. We can talk about that some other time. But, you know, maybe JP Morgan will pay a fine, but that's not the biggest takeaway to me. That's not the most important takeaway to me.
Okay, Luke, I'm going to ask you to do us a favor. In the tweet that we used to announce today's episode, I'm looking at this Bloomberg chart right now because you were kind enough to email it to me. Please reply to that tweet and tweet that chart because it's a great chart and it shows exactly what you're talking about, that there was this divergence in gold price and negatively yielding debt, which is what usually gold prices follow. There's a very clear divergence there, and I want our listeners to see it. So listeners, look for the tweet announcing this episode of Macro Voices All-Stars. Luke will post the chart as a reply right there. Let's come back to the chart, though. Luke, you said that was not the biggest takeaway. Okay, what is the biggest takeaway in your view from this chart?
So to me, the biggest takeaway is just something based on sort of intuition and more importantly, on something I learned from nearly 20 years on the sell side in investment research, which was that if you want a bank compliance department to crack down on a behavior, indict and or heavily fine another bank for that behavior. Every other bank will quickly stop doing it because nothing gets a bank compliance department attention faster than an indictment somewhere else in the industry. And so, you know, going back, September 16th, 2019, JP Morgan's precious metals desk gets indicted for manipulating the precious metals market. And almost immediately, gold stopped going down on rising real rates, which to me is just a very interesting market development.
You know, that's a really important insight I just want to expound on a little bit, because when I first got involved in the professional side of finance, one of the things that just shocked me is every other industry I've ever seen, you know, people think about, okay, what are the rules? What are the regulations we have to follow and so forth? In finance, they have no shame just talking about what you can get away with. I've gone to professional finance conferences and people talking about this regulation or that regulation, and some lawyer shows up and says, oh, don't worry, I follow all the enforcements and I've never seen that rule enforced. And everybody's like, oh, okay, great. You know? So I couldn't agree more with you that what gets their attention is when they actually start enforcing rules, whether or not they're the law or not, doesn't seem to bother anybody in this crazy industry. So why do you think the U.S. government did this? Do you think they were picking on JP Morgan, saying, okay, we need a scapegoat in order to send the message to the rest of the industry? Or do you think that they were targeting JP Morgan for a different reason and it's just going to have that indirect or consequential effect?
You know, it's hard to say, right? Because it's come out since, of course, that JP Morgan on September 16th and 17th, you know, stop supplying liquidity into the repo markets, that they were sort of a big reason why repo markets did what they did. And, you know, I've had conversations with people that have said, you know, well, maybe this is just the government coming down on JP Morgan for doing that. And I, you know, I could see clear to that maybe if, you know, if the February 5th article we read before about the, you know, the bank being looked at criminally for this was the first episode. But, you know, this indictment was being reported on in September 16th. So my guess is it came down before then. And so I don't know that this is going after JP Morgan per se, other than like if JP Morgan is in trouble for it, everyone's going to like, if you shoot the generals and the troops will follow. So to me, it's probably more of that. And regardless, you know, to me, that's secondary to the fact that, you know, that the government did it right at the end of the day. We can speculate as to why, but the bottom line is the government did it. They indicted JP Morgan's precious metals desk. And so to me, that expresses a clear message that as of September 16, 2019, the U.S. government wants the price of gold higher.
Okay, you just triggered me with that line, Luke, because if you follow all of the conspiracy theories in the gold bug universe, which frankly, I don't subscribe to a lot of them, but in that world of gold bugs, it has been widely, widely believed for many years that the U.S. government is very actively involved in some sort of conspiracy to systematically suppress the price of gold. So you're saying they want the opposite? Does that mean they changed, or does that mean you disagree with that view, or what does that mean?
You know, I'm obviously well aware of some of the, you know, the thought process that they have, that they, the U.S. government has not wanted to see the price of gold rise, or at least elements within it. You know, what's interesting within that is it's not just the gold bug community. There are declassified or U.S. embassy cables from Beijing noting that the Chinese authorities believe that the U.S. and the Europeans have manipulated the price of gold downward as well. And so it's not just the gold bug community, it's the PBOC as well. But that's a whole separate other discussion. I mean, the punchline to me is, I think they want it up, the price of gold. I think the U.S. government wants the price of gold up by virtue of this action. And why? You know, it could be as simple as, you know, Trump administration and the Treasury seems to want the dollar down. The Fed clearly wants inflation up. And boy, if I could come up with sort of a one-stop shop to get the dollar down and inflation up, you know, I would let gold run at, you know, 15% a year, 20% a year for a couple years. And sooner or later, markets will wake up and go, if there's no inflation, why is gold at 2,200 or something like that, right? And so I think that is ultimately the key takeaway to that.
Well, and the good news here is we don't need to speculate on whether any conspiracy or PBOC theory or anything else is true or not. We don't need to care what the motivations are. If it's positive for gold, it's positive for gold. I personally think that the long-term fundamentals for gold are incredibly solid. So seems like just yet another reason to be investing in gold.
Yeah, I think that's right, Eric. I agree. Especially, like you said, when the other fundamentals seem so good from both a macro, perspective and a supply demand standpoint. And there's, you know, a bunch of things I could list.
Okay, I'll take you up on it. Go ahead and list away.
Sure. So Bloomberg recently noted that global gold mine reserves have been falling every year since 2012 with the senior gold producers. And they have a chart on that from Bloomberg. I'll attach below the chart you referenced below. Additionally, global gold mine production in total just fell year over year in 2019 for the first time since 2008. As we've noted countless times before in conversation, you know, gold demand from central banks has been rising for 10 years. And furthermore, gold is really just a high yield bond of infinite duration and finite issuance relative to 12, 13, 14 trillion, whatever it is these days in negative interest rate debt. And finally, from a macro perspective, to me, it still remains poorly understood that last September, the Fed was forced to begin growing its balance sheet again to cap overnight yields, and therefore to cap yields on the U.S.'s own sovereign debt, because the U.S. government can't afford to pay Treasury yields as high as where repo rates had gone, which would have been the marginal cost of financing for those Treasuries. So any one of these fundamentals would be positive for gold by themselves. And when you take them all together, to me, like you said, it's as bullish a setup for gold as we've seen in at least a decade. And what fascinates me is that, you know, despite all of that, most U.S. investors still, if you had a room full of U.S. investors and said, how many of you have held a 1 ounce gold coin in your hands personally? You know, my guess is it would be a severe minority of those investors. And so, you know, I suspect that'll change over the next 5 to 10 years. But I also suspect gold's price will probably have a different digit in front of it by then.
Okay, so listeners, look to that same tweet announcing this episode. By the time you get to that tweet, Luke will have replied with both of these two charts. You know, it just blows my mind, Luke, that we're even having this conversation. 10 years ago, the strongest argument that the people who didn't believe in gold were making is, look, you know, you just can't get around the fact that it doesn't produce any yield. And now it's become a selling point that you're emphasizing. No matter what, the yield can't go negative, which is the trend for sovereign debt from the strongest nations on earth, issuing negative yielding sovereign debt. And now gold has the advantage of having a zero yield in the face of negative yields from assets which have similar risk parameters. It's just amazing that we've gotten here. So needless to say, I take it you still like gold. Any caveats or other things we should understand about your outlook for gold?
No, I don't think it needs to be caveated. It's still like gold, still like Bitcoin and silver, like we've talked about before. You know, the way I look at Bitcoin, there's guys that are going to know a lot more about it than I do. They'll have forgotten more than I'll ever know. But I just look at Bitcoin as sort of a digital gold. And so I think I continue to think it's positioned pretty well along with silver.
Luke, before we close, I want to touch on the economic impacts of the coronavirus situation. You have been very, very prolific in the past in writing about China and trade with China and so forth. Regardless of whether or not this virus turns into a global pandemic, which I frankly think is a much more realistic possibility than the market is discounting, it's very, very clear that the situation in China is dire, to say the least. What are the knock-on effects in terms of supply chain and so forth that are going to be transmitted to the global economy, and what's it going to mean for markets?
It's a great question, Eric. I mean, I think obviously, you know, setting aside any of the sort of transmissional stuff where I just don't have any edge, so I would defer to others out there that have spent more time with it. When you look at the supply chain impacts, you know, one thing to me that has grabbed me has been, you know, this quick narrative of, and, you know, perpetuated by Wilbur Ross, you know, now we're going to see supply chains come back fast. You know, yeah, we'll see some movement in supply chains, but, you know, it's interesting. Number one, 7 of the 10 biggest ports in the world are in China, container ports. And, you know, that's not going to be replicated anytime soon. You're talking about years, maybe decades to, you know, and that's, you might be looking at decades just to get the permitting in certain places. You'd have to rebuild factories. You'd have to rebuild infrastructure. Oh, by the way, I'm not sure people have the steel capacity here in the U.S. to do it. So you'd probably need Chinese steel to replace the Chinese ports, which is not being thought of on a second derivative impact. And so you quickly get into sort of the first, you know, the first derivative of, oh, this will be good to get supply chains out of China. Yeah, maybe someday. But in the near term, like it's not even on an investable time horizon for anybody managing money that's going to happen. You're more likely looking at, you know, Liebig's law of the minimum holding, right? Which says, you know, as soon, you know, there's whatever part is most critical in making something, once you stop getting that part, you know, production shuts down for everything. And so there's just, you know, China is, you know, according to 2018 or 2017 per Visual Capitalist, China was the biggest trading partner with 125 nations around the world. The U.S. was the biggest trading partner with 55. So the impacts, if this stays shut down, I think will start to get very nonlinear very fast. And then they start to get, you know, one thing I have thought of too, and, you know, something we wrote about last week in our Tree Rings 10 Most Interesting Things list was, you know, look, if this does, God forbid, show up in U.S. shores, now you've got, you know, 80 million people that are underinsured or uninsured. And now all of a sudden, this is a scary thing. How does that play into the election? You got 80 million people with some sort of scary virus. You know, healthcare is probably not even probably. Healthcare is the number one election issue. People don't want to talk about that. That's the reality of it, though. You know, there's one candidate that's going to do really well if there's a healthcare scare, and there's a bunch of candidates that aren't going to do real well if there's a healthcare scare. And, you know, of course, that one that would do well would be Senator Sanders. And so, you know, there's just a lot of really nonlinear potential impacts to this, both to supply chains, to politics, to geopolitics, to currencies. So I think in terms of, you know, your point that this could be really big for economics, it could be really big for as a pandemic. And again, I just don't have any opinion on the pandemic side. But on the economic side, you know, boy, we've been starting to dig in, and, you know, it could be a really big, and it could be very nonlinear. And the last thing I'd say, Eric, within all of sort of the logistical and geopolitical currency, et cetera, economic impact, the last thing I'd say is you, when you start talking about things like this, I think it is important to remember that, particularly in the global central bank regime we're in, if underlying economic fundamentals were the sole driver of asset prices in local currency terms, at least, then I would point out Venezuela's stock market was up 5,000-some% last year in local terms. Now, of course, it fell in dollars. But again, you start getting really big disruptions, things like that. You know, I think it's important to start consider looking at not just sort of the same playbook that we've been watching from a macro perspective over, you know, most of our careers over the last 30, 40 years. So I guess I would just leave it at that.
Well, Luke, it's great as always to get your perspective. I look forward to getting you back on the show next month for another update. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast on quant and rules-based investing. Be sure to claim your free copy of their recently updated guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. And if you haven't heard it yet, be sure to check out my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following strategies, which is linked in your Research Roundup email. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.